Welcome to JW Community Podcast, where my mum is basically just blabbering on about nonsense.
Thank you, fam.
Hello and welcome to another JW Community Podcast. It's just me today. I don't have any sidekicks or co-hosts or generals, but I am interviewing a gentleman called David Fitzgerald. And David is an atheist. He serves on the board of the San Francisco Atheists. He is the director and founder of the first atheist film festival. Who knew? And also, this is so cool, David, you're the founder of the San Francisco's oldest Darwin Day celebration. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
You do a lot of public speaking, right?
I do.
Tell me about your public speaking. What do you talk about?
Well, these days, I've done all those things you talked about in the intro, and thank you for that lovely intro. But I'm best known now for being an author. Ever since about 2010, I've been cranking out books on atheism and atheist themes, especially on the historical Jesus question.
Yes, that's why we've got you on.
Yes, absolutely. And that's what I've become best known for, I think, now.
So let's name call some of your books. In 2010, you wrote Nailed, 10 Christian Myths that show Jesus Never Existed at All. Wow, that's quite bold.
Right? Isn't it, though? And again, no hyperbole at all. I'm not even exaggerating the least little bit. I really don't think the guy existed at all.
That's so interesting. So this is why how you came to my attention, that somebody, I should be able to say who, but I've completely forgotten. Somebody in the XJW community said, you've really got to speak to this man. He's written some really interesting books. It'd make a great podcast. And I was just so privileged that you were willing to come on, because I can only pay you in actual peanuts.
my pleasure. Okay, and I should just, I want to say right out of the gate, before we get too far down the Jesus path, that I've written a book on the Mormons, and my next book in that series will be about the JWs as well.
Right. So that was going to be my first question, because you're not an ex-JW, but what is your interest in these crazy cults?
Well, I mean, you named it right there. I'm interested in all kinds of things in religion, especially Western religion. And once I did a book on the Mormons, that was super fun, because that is such a crazy, wonderful world of delusion and wonder. And as soon as I did that, people started saying, oh, when are you going to do Scientology? When are you going to do Islam?
Gonna do
it's like, when I have a 24/7 security budget, you know, I'll tackle both of them. But I thought, well, you know, I could do the JWs though, because everybody bumps into them. They're always, you know, hanging around at the train stations and stops. And as soon as I started talking to that, so many XJWs have gotten so excited about it. So even though it's still about three books down the pipeline, I'm really getting more and more excited about doing the book and talking to XJWs and getting their perspective and just you know, getting it out there.
We get excited about stuff. We do get excited about anybody who's not an XJW who shows the slightest bit of interest at all. But what made you do Mormons first, though? Are you an ex-Mormon?
No, I'm not, actually. I was raised Southern Baptist, and that's a whole different thing, too, because my Baptist brain and my atheist brain can both agree that the Mormons are completely wrong. But it just worked out that way, because I inherited this library from an atheist friend of mine who was a huge researcher into Mormonism and had all these amazing decades of research on them and reprints of books that are from Christian apologists who take on Mormons, and just some really amazing stuff that had blew my mind, that wasn't common knowledge, and especially about the origins of the Book of Mormon and the archaeological.
There's some crazy stuff about Egyptology, isn't there? And some guy who could only interpret some Egyptology crap, and he had to get paid to go and sit in a darkened room for years and come out and tell everybody what it meant.
Exactly. And they believed it.
Yeah, I know.
That's the thing that blows my mind. And now it's even worse, because now we have Egyptologists who have cracked the code on the hieroglyphics, and we know what ancient Egyptians were saying in their books. And it's like, yeah, it's just like the Catholic Church all over again. It's like, I can't believe you're not done now. After this and after this and after this, it's just one thing after another. Mormonism, it's like, how are you guys still a thing at all?
It blows my mind. It gets too big, doesn't it? And it goes too far down the line. So there are so many people that don't even know that ancient history stuff. Yeah. And they go, oh, well, that's all old stuff anyway. You know, we've got new light now or whatever.
Right, right. Drives me crazy. Right.
So from the Mormon stuff, you rolled on and XJW's got a hold of you and said, do us.
Yeah.
So to speak.
So I actually went from book one. The whole series itself is called The Complete Heretic's Guide to Western Religion. And so I kind of wanted to just tackle all these different subjects. The next one I'm going to be doing is sex and violence in the Bible.
Oh, which is brilliant.
It's a talk I love to give. It's probably the most popular talk I give. And I can't wait to get that book out.
Sex and violence in the Bible.
Yes.
That's quite dangerous in America. They would hound you down with tortures for that, surely.
You know, you'd think so. But once I wrote a book saying that Jesus didn't exist, I was expecting that reaction too. And it's kind of amazing. It's I'm able to keep going.
Yeah, maybe it's a bit like talking about sex. It's you're talking about the thing that nobody dares talk about, but everybody wants to hear about.
That's what we're hoping. That's what we're hoping. Yeah. The talk itself is very popular too, though. I had a friend who said, Dave, I brought two Christian friends with me to see your talk. And they spent the whole time with their jaws just wide open. And I got an email from her like 2 days afterwards and said, they've left their church.
Oh, you kidding?
No joke at all.
Wow.
No joke.
You're probably the first person that's made them think critically about things.
Or maybe it's just that constant pressure building, you know, where you're in denial, and all of a sudden that one straw hits the camel's back and boom, it all pops open. But I like the way you think. Yeah, I'd love to think it was all my fault. That was.
Oh, no, I'm sure it was. No, definitely, because you're probably the tipping point. As you say, you're in denial, but you do need something that tips you. And if you are the tipping point, that's great. Wow.
Do you have an elevator pitch for your tipping point for JWs?
Do you know what? I don't. I think everybody's tipping point is different. For me, I still believed it when I left. But you do have this thing. There's this saying where if you don't understand anything, they say, well, just leave it with Jehovah. You know, leave it with Jehovah. And I call it the Jehovah shelf. And you put so many things on the Jehovah shelf. And eventually the Jehovah shelf gets so heavy that it just like crashes down and smacks you on the head. But you can put quite a lot on there before you.
Sure. Oh, sure. I love that metaphor, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to have to.
Yours. It's yours. Yeah, that and peanuts is the only way I can pay you. Metaphors and peanuts. That's my standard rate for a podcast.
I'm delighted to be here.
So then I need you to tell me about your, without spoiling the fact that people need to buy the book, right? So
and clearly
no spoilers.
They do. Clearly they do. Yeah.
Clearly they need to buy the book, but, So even me as an atheist, I'm a bit skeptical because I do kind of believe that Jesus was a human being. I don't think he was like anyone special.
And I have to say, I was the exact same way 20 years ago. If I was telling you, if someone was telling me what I'm telling you now 20 years ago, I would have laughed too. Ironically enough, I mean, I've been an atheist for 16 years, it never once crossed my mind that there was no Jesus at all.
No, exactly.
Never once crossed my mind until I got curious to figure out what Jesus, the real Jesus, said and did and what was just legendary bullshit that got accreted into the Gospels. And once you start trying to parse that out, the real Jesus from the obviously fake Jesus, all of these red flags start popping up, and not just the contradictions in the Gospels, but the way if there was a real Jesus, how can Mark get away with saying this over here and John get away with saying this over here? It wasn't just eyewitness testimony being a problem. It wasn't just discrepancies in that. It's like, no, we're talking basic things. And the timeline, when you read the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and read what happened just the last 2 weeks of Jesus' life, and then read the last two weeks of Jesus' life in John, they're completely different. They're not. There's no. There is absolutely no correspondence whatsoever. And I'll give you just one example. In John, Jesus gets killed because he raises Lazarus from the dead, and the Jewish leaders freak out about it because everyone is so blown away by this miracle that they're afraid he's going to become the new hot thing or whatever, and they'll be out of a job. So that's how why they kill him. Lazarus isn't even a character in the other gospel.
Really?
There's a one parable from Luke that has a guy named Lazarus. It's not the same guy. Other than that, he doesn't appear at all. He's killed. Jesus is killed for completely different reasons in the gospels. And there's other fundamental differences from gospel to gospel to gospel. But the thing that really started blowing my mind was when I realized, this found out as a Christian, that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John did not write the gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Those names were added in the second century. And I remember my pastor, telling me this just off the cuff as a Christian, saying, oh yeah, that's probably not the guys who wrote them.
Like, no big deal.
That blew my mind. It's like, well, why do people say that then?
It was Scott, Randy, Stuart, and Michael that wrote them. What the hell?
It's even worse than that. It's guys 100 years later, probably more than one of them, putting it together, or at least generations later, for sure. For sure.
So would you say, just from the internal evidence of the four Gospels, from that alone, you would say Jesus is a bit of a made-up?
Well, I mean, honestly, that is a strong, strong thing. When you, that's like the first red flag, is when you realize, A, that the Gospels weren't written by eyewitnesses, B, they don't claim to be written by eyewitnesses, and when you read them, there's a thing called the synoptic problem that biblical scholars have talked about, and what it basically means is they recognize that all the Gospels are based off Mark, that Mark, our most humble, most fallible Jesus, our shortest gospel, that's the original gospel that was written sometime in the late 70s of the first century, right after the Jewish war with Rome, or at least the oldest parts of that gospel were written then. The whole thing may have been written, closer to the end of the first century even. That's just one thing. But here's the killer thing. Wait, we haven't even got to the good part yet.
Oh, go on, the good bit.
That's crazy enough that they're all based on the one gospel, because basically, if you look for biographical information on Jesus, there's nothing outside the Bible, nothing really in the epistles even, and Paul, everything comes from those four gospels, and everything in those four gospels comes from this first gospel, Mark, our no-frills, low-budget Jesus.
Low-budget Jesus reporter.
And when you read that gospel, when you look closely at it, it looks like the whole thing is an allegory and meant to be understood as an allegory. Yeah.
And then the others take it and kind of embellish a bit. So I can see the first problem here is that you need to be quite a bit of a scholar to even take four different records and compare them side by side and identify that. Because if you were just a bit of a, an ordinary person.
Sure.
Look, most of the average reading age for people in my country is about 12 years old. And that is...
You've got us beat by a mile, I'm sure, too.
And that's where the main national newspapers pitch reading age of 12. And my son's still at primary school. He's 11. So one more year, and what he can read will be what most of the country can read, apart from a few people who do a lot of reading.
Sure. And you've already passed Donald Trump by that point, too.
Yeah, oh, without a doubt. I mean, he's almost functionally illiterate, isn't he?
Thank you.
Oh, he's a bullet point man. He says he wants he wants the entire Middle East policy on one page with eight bullet points.
With lots of pictures and bright colors. But let's not go down this rabbit hole.
It's a rabbit hole I'd love to go down.
Yeah.
So straight away, I remember being a witness, and we prided ourselves on being scholars and doing lots of reading. Mm-hmm. But really and truly, you're taking people who are not allowed to do any further education anyway, who've got, an average reading age of 12, pitched at the Sun newspaper probably. you're not going to suddenly start putting gospels side by side and measuring them up and analysing them and going, oh, this style's different to this style. I mean, even you saying Mark is a no-frills gospel writer, like, I didn't know that because I just read it without thinking.
Yeah, and this is the thing, is it's not just all these facts. It's the fact that they are presented as something they're not. And we're expected to, like, just take scholars' word for it, oh, that we've got all these questions figured out, and, you know, and they still insist. I mean, if you ask any Christian out there, 99% of them will say, oh, yes, Mark and Matthew and Luke and John, they all knew Jesus and hung out with Jesus. And they were,
that's what I thought. You
know, and it's like, scholars know that's not true.
My
and
God.
Yet, Bart Ehrman, who's written so many good books, just kind of blowing the curtain back on biblical studies, points out that it's like, yeah, you act like I'm, you know, you're saying, oh, yeah, that's not a secret. We knew that. Well, how come your flocks don't know that? How come your churches don't know that? They're acting, oh, no, we're not keeping a secret. Well, you're doing a great job of keeping it a secret if you're not.
I'm not exposing it. Wait, yeah. So did they not, were those guys not handing out fishes and breads and stuff?
Thank you. They were not. They were not. Yeah.
Oh my God, I feel so ignorant already. I'm just
this is why I love what I do, because it's fascinating to me. It's not just that Christianity is bullshit. It's amazing bullshit.
Right.
And it's still being, there's so many surprises for people who haven't looked into this. Who really wrote the Gospels? When were they written? Where were they written? How different are our manuscripts? You know, just looking at the existing New Testament manuscripts that we have, it's fascinating to see you. Well, first, it's hilarious to hear Christians brag about how many Christian documents there are. There's thousands and thousands of New Testaments that aren't anything in the ancient world at all. Such bullshit. Such pure, unflinching bullshit. Because there's probably even more than they're saying. There's probably about 24,000 Old Testament or New Testament manuscripts. But that's not the real question. The question is, when were they written? If it's an 8th century, 9th century manuscript, that doesn't matter at all. That just means how many monks did you have working on the project? What we need to know is how many root manuscripts we have. How many of these, tracing these, where these copies of copies of copies of copies go back to. Now, when you do that, all of a sudden Christianity doesn't look so good compared to...
It dwindles down very quickly.
It sure does. In fact, we don't even have complete books of the New Testament until towards the end of the second century.
So 200 years after...
Almost 200 years. Between 150 and 200 years, we have nothing but scraps that will fit on like the back of a credit card all the way up until the end of that century. When we get to the very end of the second century, the third century, then we start getting complete books. We don't get complete New Testaments until the fourth century. So now we're talking, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years after Christianity. We have the Codex Sinaiticus and the Codex Vaticanus, these two complete New Testaments. But the problem with them is that they don't agree with each other. They have books, and neither of them agrees with our New Testament. We have books they don't have. They have books we don't have. It's fascinating.
It
and
is.
when you get to the first 100 years of Christianity, we have nothing, nothing at all.
Really?
We don't even have the fragments. We have absolutely nothing that survives for until towards the end of the second century. So all these Christians who will go on air and apologists who will say, oh, well, our New Testaments today are 99.99% accurate. And we know that. It's like, how do you even know? If you had magically saved all the New Testament in a black box, you know, that Paul kept under his bed and we just found it now, we wouldn't know we were looking at the originals. We'd say, oh, well, here's a weird variant
box
of this
stuff,
manuscript.
Yeah.
We have no way of knowing. No way of knowing.
There's a brilliant video on YouTube somewhere. It's a cartoon, and it's not an XJW one. It's just somebody's done it like it's a quiz. They've done it as a quiz. And so there's like two little cartoon characters, and they have to answer, and the compere asks them a question like, how many blind men did Jesus cure? And one will go two, and the other will go three, and he'll go correct to both of them. But the video goes on for ages, and there's loads of questions like that where they both give a different answer, and they're both correct. And underneath, he puts the gospels that the two answers have come from.
Yeah.
And
it's
that,
so awesome.
That is absolute genius, because I had no idea. And I, as a witness, I used to go out knocking doors and people would go, "Oh, the Bible contradicts itself." And I'd go, "Oh, no, it doesn't." "Oh, yes, yeah, it does." "No. Oh, no, 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 it doesn't. No, I've studied it. I didn't have a Scooby-Doo. I have never compared one with another."
It's so true. Dan Barker from the Freedom From Religion Foundation has a thing he calls the Easter Challenge. And he says, "Okay, Christians, here's the thing. Just read the four Gospels and tell me what happened."
Right. Yeah.
"And here's the only rule. Here's the only rule. You can't leave out anything they say happened in there."
Okay.
So you, and now yeah, tell me what happened and see, try to make sense. It is so ridiculous to compare them.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And yet, the four Gospels, the New Testament Gospels, are probably what Christians read a lot of. Like, I didn't read all that Old Testament stuff.
Sure.
It was just like old crap about the Israelites. And the Israelites, I'll be honest with you, used to get on my tits.
Slaughtered
because they were so supercilious.
Philistine foreskins and everything.
All
yeah,
that stuff and driving pegs through people's genitals. And I just thought, oh, do you know, this is never going to happen now. So I'm not going to take any notice of that. I'll just stick to New Testament. It's a bit more realistic.
Jesus took care of all that. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, Jesus got rid of all that peg genital stuff. Bless him. But even given that that's what I was concentrating on, I clearly wasn't reading anything or taking anything in at all. We're in 2018. Is not our date based on Jesus? Am I being really stupid?
Oh, well, I mean, you are and you aren't.
Okay.
it's like Christians will sometimes say, "Well, it's the year of our Lord, blah, blah, blah."
And I'll say,
you're saying that on Thursday, Thor's Day.
On Thor's Day, Jesus.
They laugh about the calendar until you point out that most of their months and all of the days in their week are pagan gods and, you know, Saturn and, you know, Mars. And yeah, anyway. And then they say, "Oh, okay." And then they, yeah, so.
So and, how did we decide when Nort was? It was that not when Jesus was born or died or,
so, yeah, well,
or
there
got
is
baptized?
No, yeah, there is no actual year zero or year Z, I think. Is that the word? No, it's zero.
I don't know, because I'm dead ignorant. Relying on you to enlighten me.
The calendar we have now was invented, you know, sometime in the Middle Ages by some monks.
That's really interesting, because I thought, like, literally everybody in the world had agreed. Like, okay, guys, to this year is number one. We all agreed? Yeah, we're all agreed.
Yeah, no, didn't happen like that at all. And the funny thing about it was meant to be starting with the year Jesus was born. But now that they've done the math, they think Jesus was either born in like 10 BC, somewhere between 6 and 10 BC, or 6 AD, depending on which gospel you have to believe. Because
yeah,
Matthew and
back
Mark,
to the gospels Matthew, again.
Yeah, and they don't agree at all on when it could possibly be, and that's caused so much mental gymnastics on the Christian side to make those numbers work, and they just don't. Same thing with Jesus' death. And in fact, not only does his birth and death, we don't have any way to pin down when that was, not even the year, but we can't pin down anything that happened in Jesus' life.
Okay.
Even though we know what time of the afternoon and what day, you know, Vesuvius erupted, we know what time Cleopatra put the asp to her breast, we know the dates and times of so many things in the ancient world, we have no clue about anything that happens in Jesus' life. Not a damn thing.
Right. So that's like a second way of verifying your argument then, isn't it? That we do have so many accurate records for other ancient stuff.
Sure.
That Jesus is just a little bit woolly and foggy and nefarious.
And not only that, but it's not even just an argument from silence saying nobody mentioned it. We also do have evidence of things that were going on in Jerusalem at the time. And we have evidence of all these other loser messiahs and wannabe messiahs from the first century. They weren't anywhere near as interesting as what Jesus did. And yet every single one of them made a dent in the historical record. And that's something Jesus doesn't do for almost 100 years.
I love that. I'm just going to put this out there. My ex-partner calls me the Pied Piper of the losers. That's how he rates my activism. So I count myself as a loser messiah.
It's a badge of honor.
Yeah, I'm there with him.
less evidence for him. And what's even crazier is the two things that are mostly brought up. They say, oh, no, we have all these contemporary witnesses to Jesus. You'll hear Christians say this. I've heard Christian preachers tell me to my face, oh, no, there's about 50 to him. And it's like, you are lying to yourself because we don't have anything contemporary with Jesus. Full stop. Nothing whatsoever. In the entire first century, the only extra biblical witness we have to Jesus is supposedly from this historian, Flavius Josephus.
Yes, Josephus. Oh, he's the main man. I remember saying his name a lot when I was a witness. Yeah. I don't know who he is.
And here's the thing. There's two disputed passages, and I spend much ink explaining why one isn't even talking about our Jesus at all, full stop, and the other one is a forgery, full stop, period. And it's a late forgery. It's a forgery from like 100, 300 years later, and no one knows about it except for this one guy. In 500 years, only one guy is citing this,
and he got
his copy of Josephus from a guy who complained about Josephus not saying anything about Jesus. There's so many ways that story just breaks apart. It falls apart. And yet Christians want to drag and say, well, okay, well, we know it's a partial forgery, but it's not a complete forgery. No, it's a whole goddamn forgery from start to finish for many reasons, for multiple reasons.
Is that not a curate's egg? No, the curate says the egg is partially off, but not entirely off.
it's amazing how they'll change the goalposts and so desperately. And the reason they do, they have to, because if those two disputed passages of Josephus are debunked, and they have been, that means for the whole first century, there's nothing about Jesus. And when you look at the ones that they brought out, and you'll hear them, you'll hear people, Christians, say this quite blatantly, that there's dozens and dozens and dozens. No, there's about 17. There's about 17 so-called eyewitness things for Jesus, and I break them all down and show that most of them aren't even in the first century, the second century, or the third century. They're later and later and later and later. And most of them aren't even talking about Jesus. They're talking about Christians and what Christians were doing at such and such a time.
Oh, then, no, so I get that because I did that once. Yeah. When you do your teacher training, I'm going to segue to a little story now.
Sure.
Okay? When you do your teacher training, one of the things you have to do, you go into a secondary school and they give you a pupil to follow for a day to give you an understanding of what a child's day is like, and they give you the name. You don't know who the kid is because it's a new school to you, and you do what's called a pupil pursuit. So I was given the name of this girl
in
it is, it's not a paedophilia because you're allowed you've been told to do it, and when I did my teacher training, I pursued this girl all day and I was supposed to observe every lesson she did. And then afterwards, the next week, I found out that the girl that I was allegedly following all day hadn't been in school that day. And what I'd done, I'd just gone into each lesson that she was in and kind of picked an average girl. They all look the same to me. You know, like a 14-year-old, they're kind of slim, they've got long hair, they're all called Chloe. So I must have picked like six different looky-likey Chloes, thinking it was the same girl. And I wrote a whole bloody essay on this girl's day, and she wasn't even in school. And then I spent a week.
This is a poignant metaphor for something. I don't know what for, but that is a beautiful metaphor.
For Jesus, isn't it? Like, like the Gospels did a Jesus pupil pursuit, and they were all looking at somebody different, or a general guy that just had long hair and a beard and sandals, and somebody who looked like he'd been in a Monty Python film. They all
you
thought
don't
it was Jesus.
Laugh or cry. You don't
I've
know
done
whether
that.
To laugh or cry.
I have literally done it, and I wrote a whole assignment on it, and then I agonized because you put your assignments into the university, which isn't the school, but you've done the assignment in the school. And I just thought, what if the university check with the school? Like, what if they check the attendance record and find that the girl that wasn't even in school?
Like, how did you find out that was the case? That all
remember.
These Chloes weren't the same Chloe?
I think I got suspicious by the end of the day that they all looked a little bit different.
Because somebody could do a paper just on this phenomena that you uncovered. This.
I'm thinking that you're looking at one person and you're just looking at a vague amalgam of people that look like the person you think. I mean, I will admit I do have very poor facial recognitions. But no, I get that. So if I'd have been a gospel writer, I could have easily written about like six different fellas that all had beards and blue eyes.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing you bring up, because that kind of is sort of the default for most atheists I run into, is that, oh, I'm sure there was a guy named Jesus or a bundle of guys that, and I have to say, there's nothing improbable about that, because yeah, absolutely right. There were tons of messiahs at the time. But when we look at what our evidence for Jesus is, it doesn't point to the telephone game. It doesn't point to oral transition getting wonky in the, and you know, mix-ups.
Right.
There's some really interesting parallels with people, but everything we know from our gospels seems to be the guy that we call Mark deliberately setting out writing a literary construction and using very sophisticated theological, not even just Jewish theology, but he was obviously well educated in Greek classic literature as well, because we see all these different techniques he uses, including using this very folksy down home kind of Koine Greek to give it this charming, simple homespun feel to it. And he's these very sophisticated literary structures, these chiastic structures and these intercalations and things like this, that show that he knew exactly what he was doing and that he's clearly taking these motifs from classic Greeks, from the Bacchae, from Homer, from the Old Testament, you know, you name it, and blending them into this mix.
So you've got a really intelligent guy who's kind of writing in a vernacular that people would get.
Exactly, okay. Exactly, you know.
So you're prepared to accept that Mark existed?
Yeah, I mean, we shouldn't call him Mark because that wasn't his name.
No, that's very
All those names were assigned sometime in the second century.
Right.
But definitely that guy who wrote that gospel, that first gospel of Mark, that was a watershed moment for Christianity, because when we look at Christianity before that book is written and we look at Christianity after that book is written, they're two completely different animals.
Whoa.
And the Jesus of Paul and every other Christian writer of his generation and before is so different from the one who Mark writes about and the one who later people called Matthew and people called Luke, which were not their real names either. By the time Luke writes his gospel, he starts out his gospel by saying, there's so many people writing gospels right now. I thought it would be a good idea to go and research the actual facts that were handed down to our generation, which is a lie because all he does for the most part is steal from Mark and Matthew. But all these guys, none of them were setting out to write their gospel. They were all setting out to write the gospel, you know, and just make the correction and fix the mistakes, you know. And it's fascinating to see that the differences and the changes and the evolution of the gospels. And again, Bart Ehrman has done such a great job of pointing out how bad the forgery problem was for early Christianity. He says it's one of the most remarkable things about early Christianity is the degree to which its documents were forged by one faction or another, trying to make Jesus say this, trying to make Paul say this or that.
Yeah. Trying to claim him and shape him.
Absolutely. And we have different endings to our existing gospels. The gospel of Mark ends at the first eight verses of chapter 16. It ends with the women running from the tomb and not telling anybody. That's the end of the book. And there's been at least two surviving endings tacked onto there. There's at least two endings to the Gospel of Luke, and we don't know which is the original one. We don't even know if either is the original one. Just watching, even when you read the Gospel of John, if you just flip to the end of that, you see the book ends, and then another story comes in, and then there's a little tack on after that. And you can read it for yourself. You can see it where these things are being added. And let's throw in a little story about in the Sea of Galilee now. And let's put a thing saying who this guy was, because none of the Gospels say who they are writing it.
It's kind of their equivalent of our YouTubing, isn't it? Like, everybody YouTubes now. And like 100 years ago, everybody used to pamphlet. And there's a proliferation of this new media. And everybody wants a look in, and lots of people copy. So, you know, however, there's 1,000 little boys all doing the Cocomenta challenge on YouTube. And one of them gets 15 million views and another one gets 30. And how that happens is just look who gets in first. And it's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
It is, because that kind of arms race was happening in the second century. And the way they got ahead of their competition was saying, well, this is the gospel according to Matthew, his pal. You know, this is the gospel according to Mary or Peter.
Who knew him and hung out with him.
It's funny that our Gospel of Mark, we're lucky to have our Gospel of Mark for starters, because Matthew is trying to replace it, Luke is trying to replace it, and John doesn't even try to match it. He's doing his own thing. But they're constantly improving on him. And in the time it was written, there was a Gospel of Peter, which is not in our Bibles, but it's even more crazier. You know, the story gets better and better with every single Gospel. And by the time we get to the Gospel of Peter, A, it was so much more popular than the Gospel of Mark, 3 times as popular. And it's crazy. The parts that we have survived, Jesus comes out of the tomb and he's 500 feet tall. And there's
that's a beautiful idea. That you each person exaggerates to become more popular.
And you can see it with just our four. Because Matthew improves on Mark and corrects his mistakes and gets better. Luke says, I think we can make it even better than that, you know, and goes his own way in other directions. And John, his Jesus might as well be wearing a t-shirt saying, I am God, and because he doesn't care who knows it. And, you know, it's like, was there a shortage of rocks in the Judea then? Because why was he not stoned for blasphemy 5 minutes into his career?
That makes total sense that you would exaggerate and make your story more interesting because it would appeal more.
And putting a name of authority on it was how they did it. And everybody was doing it. It's like if you look like a Catholic dictionary, they say, oh yeah, this was the first pope and he, you know, followed Jesus. And there's a line of succession. Da, 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 da. Well, all of the heretics were doing that as well. Everybody was doing that. And which one was the authoritative one just depended on whether you liked what they said or not, more often than not.
Just to kind of recap then, so far we've got Mark invented him, sort of.
Yes.
And well, other people copy.
Mark, before that, Jesus is the celestial Jesus who's off camera all the time. He's like, he was there at the creation of the world. He'll come someday. He never says anything about him coming back. Early Christians never say anything about a second coming. It's always, oh, the Lord's going to come any minute now, but never coming back. There's no hint of him being on earth at all. But when Mark makes this allegory, it's just irresistible. And even though you can tell from the way he wrote it that he expects his more educated readers to know what he's doing, that there's an allegory.
So he doesn't do it cynically. He doesn't make Jesus. Well, it's not an invention.
It isn't. See, he was doing what other religions were doing at the time too. They were creating these myths and these stories that had a double meaning. It's like, oh, it's a story about Mithras killing the bull, but it's really a story about the constellation Taurus being eclipsed by such and such, equinox, this kind of thing. And so they were encoding these things through numerology, through astrology, through, you know, you name it, sacred geometry. So they were telling stories, and you have a story like Jesus giving out loaves and fishes and saying, well, how many loaves and fishes did I have? 12 and 7. And he's going like, get it, 12, 7, you know. And we're meant to understand that he's talking.
Oh, we don't get it because we're all too stupid, because we've all got a reading age of 12.
Exactly.
Oh, 12 loaves and 7 fishes all the other way around.
Yeah. And that was the thing. It had this split level effect where, okay, the theologians like me, they'll understand what I'm talking about here because I use the magic words here. But the common people, they'll just think it's a good
like
story until me too, you know, until they get enough education. And that idea was irresistible. Once you had the idea that Jesus was a real guy that was back once upon a time before Jerusalem was destroyed, and he really lived, then that idea was irresistible. And next thing you know, people are writing more gospels. People are saying, well, my gospel came from the real Jesus and da, 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 da. And before that, before anybody does that, everything about Jesus is something that they discovered by either A, Jesus speaking to them from heaven, or them reading the old Hebrew scriptures and saying, oh, this is talking about Jesus, really. This is actually a quote from Jesus. It's fascinating. And I've got 4 books worth of fascinating details like that, that are chock full of that.
So does anyone pick up Jesus and start running with it cynically, knowing that?
See, that's the question. I mean, the short answer is yes, absolutely. The more difficult answer is, did Mark really intend it to be a con job like Joseph Smith, you know?
Yeah.
It's like same thing with the founders of Jehovah's Witnesses.
Oh, absolutely.
Were they sincere or they're not? There's this whole question when you get the founder figures like that.
And it's still now, yeah. You know, are they doing it cynically? Are they deceiving 7 million people, or do they genuinely believe it? And they're
it started one thing and become something else.
Yeah.
And, you know,
the ends justify the means. You know, they know that they're doing bad things along the way, but they think, yeah, but we're getting people to paradise, so it's worth, you know, fiddling with the blood doctrine and what have you.
There were early Christian church fathers who basically said the exact same thing. The church father Origen says, basically, you can't read the scriptures literally. That would be crazy. It makes no damn sense.
Right.
But you have to read them allegorically, symbolically, and mystically. And they break down, you know, it's funny because we still have some early critiques of Christianity. And the only reason we have them is because the Lee Strobels of that day and the Josh McDowells of that day preserved their arguments and their responses to them. That's the only reason we have any critiques left of Christianity, is because the heresy hunters and the apologists would respond to them. But there were people in the first, in the second century, and third century calling out Christianity and saying, look, you got this in the gospel. That could never happen. Like the Sea of Galilee, that's not a sea. It's a lake, and it's only, you know, you could cross it in 2 hours. And the way they would respond, they would first say, well, God created water, so he can name it whatever he wants. You know, that's. But then they go on and they say, and besides all of this symbolism in there, like the boat is the church and, you know, the is our life. And it's like the fact that it could not happen in reality doesn't bother them at least a little bit, because it's all symbolic and has important theological meaning. And I can't tell you how many times you'll read a book on biblical history or encyclopedia of the Bible, things like that, and you'll hear Christian apologist scholars say things like, oh, well, the book of Acts, even though it leaves much to be desired for the historian, it's a treasure trove for the theologian. And it's like, whoa, pump the brakes. Hold on. Are you kidding me? And yeah, you constantly see that kind of double talk coming from Christians.
There's a lot of easy rhetoric that you can say, isn't there?
So many bumper stickers. Yep. Yeah.
So do you not feel real? So you clearly, I mean, you've written so much about it. You clearly believe Jesus is just a myth, didn't exist as a human being.
Yeah. And all. I could be wrong, but I really don't think I am. And it wouldn't kill me either way.
No.
If it turned out there was a Jesus, not like Christianity would start making sense if there is a
yeah,
guy
you would become
Jesus.
A believer, right?
And even though there's nothing implausible about that, it's just not where our evidence points to. So I just have a really hard time looking at that and taking that theory seriously. And there's other mythological Jesus theories, like the Romans invented Christianity, and it's like, no, that doesn't make any sense either. You have to ignore centuries and decades of religious evolution to come up with something like that. So it's not like all Jesus myth is created equal. But when I look at I could be wrong, but when I look at the scholars who are out there and across the board, you know, secular scholars, Christian scholars, the things they're saying often only make sense if there was not a real Jesus walking around being preached and having any connection to people. And there's so many weird structures like that.
You must feel a huge sense of frustration then, because it's like the biggest con in plain sight.
Well, you know what's funny about it? I do, especially with the smugness of Christians, I just want to smack their smug faces. It's like, you are full of lies and you don't even know it.
Yeah.
But what cracks me up is when I wrote Nailed in 2010, the response, I mean, I expected Christians to hate it.
Yeah.
But I was blown away by how many atheists went after me and said, oh, really? No, that's pseudoscience. That's pseudohistory. And when I came out with last year or early this year, what year is this? Anyway, where are we? When I came up with the follow-up book, Jesus Mything in Action, and see, Nail just talked about the top 10 ways that the official story of Christianity just does not work. It falls flat. Jesus Mything in Action says, where did Christianity come from? Yeah. Well, let's look at it. Boom. And when you put that on the table, it's the reaction has been completely different. Just in the 7 years since Nailed came out, I so much more positive reaction to Jesus Mything in Action. And now I'm more likely to hear somebody say, oh, yeah, I never thought Jesus was real. It's like, oh, fuck off.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did.
I remember. But I mean, in a sense, that really delights me. And when I see Christian billboards saying, Jesus is real, he really did exist, it's like, yeah, that is adorable. Because I feel like I made a difference, and mythicists like me have made a difference, because these questions aren't going away. Like I said, they were making these arguments right from the beginning, you know, and these arguments that these guys in the second century are holding up still hold up. They still hold up, and there is no good answer for them.
My favourite slogan outside a church is, Christ is risen, indeed. Doesn't even make English sense. It's not a sentence. Christ is risen. Christ has risen. That past tense. It's not is, right? It doesn't rise every day. Well, I mean, unless it's like me. I rise every day from my bed and go, Christ is risen, indeed. You don't say indeed at the end of a... That makes no... It gets me that. It's really bad English.
It might as well be, oh, Lord, you are not made up.
Yeah.
You are not just pretend. It's content-free.
I'll agree. That's not my best argument against Christ existing. It's just bad English.
But it is funny how even the earliest Christian preachers, even before there was such a thing as people preaching a Jesus on earth, they were saying things like, Christ is risen. And what was their source for that? Well, when you look at what Paul says and what any of the others say, they always constantly say, we know that Christ died for our sins, according to the scriptures, and that the third day he rose, according to the scriptures, and he went up to heaven, according to the scriptures. Everything they know about Jesus and what he said and did are taken from the Hebrew scriptures. And even in as late as the first century and the second century, early church fathers were quoting Jesus by saying something somebody said in the Old Testament, whether in context or out, you know. That's what they were. That was the voice of the Spirit, and the Spirit and Jesus were the same thing. And then 300 years later, the Spirit, the Son, and the Father all became this one Trinity. And that's a whole evolutionary story by itself.
Yeah. So who got killed on a cross stake?
See, this is the thing. Lots of people did all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't look like there was anybody who got killed in the 30s in first century Judea. It looks like right out of the box, Christianity started as a once upon a time story, at least as far as Jesus goes. The earliest Christianity was, this is all happening like Hercules and his 12 labors. It's all really happening up in heaven, whether you say it happened in Thrace or Greece. We're really talking about constellations and stars. And it's the same thing. The earliest Christianity we have, and there's different kinds, are all finding this demigod of their own, you know, because Christianity is just a Jewish version of all these mystery faiths that were coming around in that time. It's so ironic. No, it's not ironic. It's no coincidence at all. But it's like the Jews never had any sense that there was anything but one God, just one God and his angels, until we get to the time when all these mystery faiths come and they start creating the idea of a personal savior. They have sacred meals, Lord's suppers, all these things, and baptisms and things, all these things about a personal savior that make their way into Christianity. I mean, they don't make their way into it. Christianity is a Jewish version of the mystery faiths. That's period, full stop. That's where Christianity came from.
This really begs the question, Do you buy Christmas presents?
You know, the funny thing about this, and I have a whole talk on Christmas too, by the way, Christmas as we celebrate it is so different from Christianity. It's so removed from Christianity. It's both older than Christianity and post-Christianity.
Yeah.
I mean, we have Charles Dickens to thank for our Christmas as much as anybody else, really. But it's fascinating that, you know, all these things that are associated with Christmas that have nothing to do with Christ whatsoever, and how far those pagan traditions came back and from how many directions they come into Christianity. Christianity is just such a fascinating, huge enchilada of stuff. It just blows my mind how many different things from all these different cultures became our religion and how it continues to evolve every day for thousands of years. And it has not even come close to stopping evolving now.
It is fascinating, isn't it? It is like a mass hysteria. Not hysteria, but it's a mass delusion that everybody's agreed to buy into.
It is. And it's so funny to hear them disagreeing about the nitpicking
the
about
the nit bits of it, as if, I know, as if the minutiae of detail mattered when the whole thing is fundamentally not based in any historical facts.
Yeah. And when you see what the earliest Christians were arguing about, it's like, you think we argue about stuff as Christians now, all our different denominations. They couldn't even agree how many gods there were. They couldn't even agree if Jesus was a man or a spirit or something else or just a myth. You know, everything that we've even established and pinned down, none of that was established back in the day when Christianity started, when it was never just one thing. It was all these other movements and coming into its own. And all these superstitions, all this magic, all these other Christian writings that have since been tossed away. But, you know, there's all these stories of young baby Jesus growing up in Bethlehem, you know, just like there are stories of Superboy growing up in Smallville for the exact same reason. It's like, well, what did he do as a kid? And you just see this literary output just expanding and evolving. And
he was a bit of a pompous child, wasn't he? I didn't like that bit. Now I know we're talking about something that didn't happen now.
but there's some amazing stuff in the infancy gospels where Jesus is just this horrible Dennis the Menace type kid who has superpowers and, like, you know, wishes people into the cornfield and that kind of thing.
I didn't like the bit where they go to the temple and then they're coming away and they're like, oh no, where's Jesus? Where's our Jesus? Oh, nobody knows where our Jesus. And they go, oh, no, didn't you know I'd be in the house of my father? And I think, oh, you smarmy little snot. I'd be in the house of my father. Oh. Yeah, I didn't like that. Couldn't live up to it as a kid.
Yeah, he's just slumming on earth the whole time.
Slumming.
He just has a bad weekend for our sins too. That's the other thing.
Yes.
Like, not like he really died. It's like, what's the problem?
I love that. Yeah. He just, like my daughter said, oh, at Easter, she said, like, I go away for 3 days. You don't see me. And then I crawl back. That's my, so Jesus did that. I'm like, yeah, Chloe. Do you have a favorite Jesus never existed argument then? Do you have like a winner that makes people gasp?
Well, I mean, just pointing out the facts that are true, whether or not Jesus existed or whether it was a real one or not, is kind of mind blowing. The more you look into them, the less relevant it matters whether he really exists or not, because Robert Price says this. It's like, everything we know, think we know about Jesus comes from these sources that have nothing to do with who the man really was. So whether there was a Jesus or not, at the end of the day, there isn't one anymore. And I think that's a really good way to put it, because, it came down to this one paradox for me anyway. It was that when you look at Jesus, the first thing you find that either he did all these amazing things, or at the very least taught all these amazing new things, and yet nobody outside his little cult notices for almost 100 years or more. Or he didn't do that. He didn't really teach that. He was just one more loser messiah. And yet somehow all over the ancient Roman Empire, not just in the Galilee, not just in Jerusalem, but in Egypt, in Syria, in Rome, in Greece, you've got these little feuding cultlets that can't agree about the first thing about this God of theirs, this Savior God. And that paradox alone for me was enough to say, hey, something is seriously wrong here.
And actually, if you're a person of faith, whether he exists or not doesn't matter, because even if he is only an allegory, if you're a person of faith, all those allegories are so important to you that does it even matter whether that, do you know what I mean? Whether a real man did it or whether it's just an allegory, you're still going to believe. I mean, it's a bit like politics or anything. You believe what you believe with no reference
right.
to the facts.
Right. And it's a good question. It's a great question. And I think it's something worth atheists arguing about, whether there was a real guy at the end of it or not. And, you know, this is why I think it's important. Not that Jesus is important, not that it really matters at the end of the day whether he was or wasn't. But everything that we know, everything that we learn about Jesus in this back and forth between the historicists who say, oh, yes, there definitely was a guy, and here's what we know about him for sure, and those who said, no, it doesn't look like that's the case. It looks like this is all an allegory. At the end of the day, everything that we learn in that back and forth between those two positions helps us call the bluff of anybody who tries to tell us that they know what Jesus would have us, how he'd have us behave or think.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. What would Jesus do? WWJD.
Exactly. And absolutely, at the end of the day, if nothing else, if you read Mything in Action and Nailed, you'll be a Jesus agnostic, because you'll realize we have no way of knowing from what our records are what this guy really said or did.
Do you not think that that's true for all knowledge, that the more you learn, the more you understand what you don't know.
Yeah. And here's the thing. I mean, it's unprecedented in historical circles for us to go through all what they've called these quests for Jesus. We just came out of the third quest for Jesus in the last 100 years. And at the end of each one of these quests, scholars have thrown up their hands and say, oh, wait, this doesn't work. This tools that we're using to determine what's real and what's fake about Jesus doesn't work. We've just come out of one of those and realized that we, once again, know less about Jesus
than we thought we knew.
And I cannot think of any single branch of any kind of history where we know less and less about our subject the more we study it. It's completely unprecedented.
It's interesting, but I do think the more you study anything, the more you understand how much you don't know. So you suddenly become aware of the vast bank of knowledge that you have. Whereas if you're ignorant, you think you know everything. You think you've got everything pegged, and you can be dogmatic, and you can be black and white in your thinking because you absolutely know. As soon as you start learning, you have to embrace ambiguous thinking.
The ambiguity. Yeah. Christians hate ambiguity.
Oh, they hate it. They want
solid things, and Jesus is sinking sand. They want solid rock.
Yeah. And that's childish. I mean, that's really childish. You know, that's what small children want. And that's what you have to give very small children, black and white. You can do this. You can't do that. You will go to bed at 7 o'clock. You won't eat that. That's fine. But
isn't that all religion in a nutshell right there? Absolutely. Yeah.
Because you don't have to think. If somebody's telling you a whole set of off-the-peg black and white beliefs, you don't have to think. It's a bit like when I walk somewhere with someone and I completely switch my brain off and forget where we've parked. And then we turn around and we go back and I go, I have literally no idea, because I wasn't thinking. Because I've devolved all my thinking to you.
Yes. I mean, it's fascinating. And it's wild to see when you go from religion to religion to religion, the similarities and all of Western religion is very authoritarian, and they gravitate to this kind of thing. Oh, here's a weird thing that came out completely as a side effect of looking into Jesus is I cannot tell you how many Buddhist scholars, how many ex-Muslim scholars have come up to me and said, you know what? We're having these exact same debates in our circles about whether the Buddha lived, whether Muhammad lived. That blew my mind.
Funny.
And when
not funny, obvious, because none of them lived.
Yeah, well, it's like it seems to be that the more I look into this, it seems to be the norm that a world religion has a mythical founder, not a real founder. And like people like Joseph Smith and L. Ron Hubbard are sort of the outliers because they were actually real, unless you count Moroni as the founder. He's as mythical as anything else. But isn't that fascinating because I mean, Muhammad, 7th century, it's like clearly we've got all this history about him. And it turns out, turns out we don't. It all starts like about 100 years after the fact. And then when they were pointing out all the problems with the history of Muhammad, it's like, oh, I totally see it. I totally see it. Now it sounds like we're talking about Jesus again.
It's so convenient that all these fellas existed before the internet.
Yes. there's a reason. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that Mormonism has got all its dirty laundry out and exposed, because all of a sudden it came right at the cusp. You know, if it had started 10 years later, no, it couldn't have happened. You know,
right.
But he got it just under the wire, and then
of
everyone
documentation.
Started picking it out. You know,
yeah. You need it all to be like a bit mystical and foggy, don't you?
Yeah, but then again, look how many times they've had the end of the world happen. How many times have the JW said, okay, the end of the world is now?
Now, and then
And it's fascinating because the believers, they don't leave in mass. They just double down. And you lose some, but the ones that stick around, they're super JWs, you know?
I know, that's so true. Because I did a podcast with my dad, and obviously Armageddon was supposed to come in 1975, and Dad became a witness in 69. And I said, like, what happened on January the 1st, 1976? And that was his description. You lost some people. But then the others doubled down because they were told, you know, these have little faith. And
yeah.
Even closer now.
Was a spiritual victory. It was a spiritual end of the world. Blah, blah. You know, the excuses just never end. Why? How to explain it away? It's fascinating. I love saying this. Christianity is not just bullshit. It's fascinating bullshit.
It is. It's really, because it's just so ubiquitous, isn't it? And in a way, it's. I mean, religion is kind of enriching in a way.
Sure, in a literary way, certainly. I mean, there's no denying the effect it's had on Western civilization. It's been huge. But for everything you can say good about Christianity,
you can say something bad.
The negative is, far outweighs it. And just the fact, honestly, just the simple fact that it's just not true.
It's a bit of a negative.
That should be enough. We don't have to lie to be good people. We don't have to lie to ourselves. We don't have to lie about, you know, make up all these excuses for this all-powerful, omnipotent God, you know.
We don't have to threaten children with some mythical rabbit that's going to come and steal the toys if they're naughty. We just have to say to them, don't be naughty, because that's not...
There's reason.
Good.
There's
and
reason.
It'll make me sad, and it'll make you sad, and it'll make society sad. You don't have to make up a story to force them into.
Yeah, exactly. You have to treat people like a grown up, not as a little kid. Exactly.
In conclusion, did Jesus exist or didn't he?
The verdict's still out. The jury's still out. No,
the jury's
The jury's not still out. Honestly, we're way past that point.
Okay.
We're way past that point. There's just no way. There's just no way. And I don't mean to be mean about it. I don't mean to be a dick about it. I don't act like I have all the answers. But yeah, there's just no way. There's just no way.
I mean, if he didn't exist, he's not going to be upset that you said he didn't exist. He's and only going to be upset if he did exist and he's listening to my podcast. Then.
When you're talking about the Jesus of faith, that guy's long. We left that guy long ago. This is the supposed Jesus of history, the mere mortal guy that may not have existed.
Just
I can't even believe that existed. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But again, I've got 4 books to explain why I feel that way too. So.
Yeah, no. And so, I mean, one of the reasons why I was really keen to have you on the podcast was a friend of mine about a year ago read a book, and I was hoping it was yours. And I asked him which book he read, because if it had been yours, I was going to ask him to co-host the podcast with. But it wasn't yours. I'm sorry.
Which one was it?
I don't know. Some of the buggers written an inferior version.
No, there's some awesome books out. Read books by Robert Price, by Richard Carrier, by Raphael Lannister. There's a great blog called Vridar that has just amazing new information all the time. That's just bringing all this to the forefront. And I mean, the genie's out of the bottle. These questions are not going away. It's just like the way evolution was able to claw its way to the top, even though all the academia was stacked against it, the church was stacked against it, and yet it prevailed because the cracks were already showing that the earth wasn't 6,000 years old. And same with Christianity. The cracks are there, and they just haven't been able to fill them in. And the more they study them, the more obvious they are. And the more you study, you know, you go to seminary, the more you're going to lose people who learn too much and learn their way out of their religion. And that's why we have a thing called the Clergy Project that I'm sure you've heard of.
I haven't, no. Tell me about the Clergy Project.
Oh, you'll have to have somebody from the Clergy Project on the show, because the Clergy Project was founded by clergymen, priests, rabbis, you name it, who lost their faith and didn't know what to do. They still have a job, you know, they're still up in there in the pulpit. And it's amazing. It's strictly for religious leaders who have lost their faith and don't know what to do. And if any of your listeners are out there, you know, don't hesitate. Go look them up. And
I will definitely look that up. That does, because that's a genuine, I mean, that's one of the reasons why Jehovah's Witnesses aren't allowed to get any additional education. Because they know as soon as anybody goes to college or university, they start critical thinking, they start questioning. And then the gaff's gone, blown.
Absolutely. And when you ask the question about, is it cynical or do they really believe it? The more you go up, it's harder for me to believe that it's not purely cynical by that point. You know,
yeah.
It's like you can't know that much about it and not know it's not complete bullshit. Mm, you know?
Yeah. That is a whole other question in itself, isn't it? That I'm, again, the jury's out on. I mean, my only argument about that is somebody said, well, a scamster, they want to get in and out quickly. They want to scam people. Whereas, like, for the governing body, the leadership of the Jehovah's Witnesses, they've been around decades and decades. So they're not, perhaps, that's an argument that they're not consciously trying to scam people. Because if
I wonder, though, we don't really have any way of knowing the answer to that. It's just knowing what we know. Clearly, they know everything we know, too. So, you know, it's like how the cognitive dissonance must be unreal. You know, the compartmentalization, who knows? But, you know, religious leaders, who knows what's going on in their heads?
Well, I think they're potatoes. I don't think they're thinking people at all. I think it's only potatoes that could remain in a cult-like religion and be an enforcer and perpetrate it. They're not thinking at all.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a level of sociopathy, in my humble opinion, that you have at a certain point you have to not care about the truth, or you have to think this is better than the truth. That this is what makes people behave, or it's like, hey, I've got all this power. I've got all this respect. I've got all this money. You know, I know a lot of Christians, in fact, who have perfectly rational, valid, good reasons for being Christians that have nothing to do with Christianity being rational or valid or good. You know, Josh McDowell, the apologist, his son, Sean, is a good friend of mine. When we interact, you know, we really enjoy each other, and yet it would make no sense for him to become an atheist just because Christianity is not true. I mean, he's part of a religious dynasty, you know.
Right.
It would hurt his family. You know, there's all reasons why it would be wrong for him to become an atheist, but I could see these amazing reasons to keep him a Christian, you know, that have nothing to do with Christianity being wrong.
Yes, yeah. That's a whole other sociological question in itself, isn't it?
For sure. For sure. And it's fascinating. If we can just survive the current Trump crisis and get back on track, it's going to be amazing what people are going to be talking about religion in this century, I think.
It is. When people look back and look at that fundamental religious right and how they supported a man who is basically morally bankrupt.
I made the joke at the time, is like, how is it that the only people who believe in the Antichrist are the ones who elected him in droves to the White House? Yeah. But that said, the internet is, for say what you want about the internet, but two things it's doing, it's putting every single atheist who thought they were isolated in contact with every other atheist on the planet.
Yeah.
And you can fact check what preachers are saying right from the pew in real time.
Yeah, you can, yeah.
And those two things are destroying, they're eroding away religion. And the numbers keep, you know, those numbers keep ticking down in our favor every day.
Well, in the age of information, ignorance is an active choice, isn't it? You have to choose to be ignorant.
And it breaks my heart to see how many people are leaping to that choice. Yeah.
But that, I believe that's because we evolved.
Yeah. And this is why we fight, because this is why we're still talking about this crazy nonsense. Even though science is so much cooler and more interesting and sex is better for you and more fun, we're talking about this crazy bullshit because it's fascinating and crazy and still controls people's lives.
My friend says that every political conversation ends up with Hitler. And I kind of think that every religious conversation ends up with Trump at the minute, doesn't it?
That's funny.
I'm not drawing any analogies there, but so I hope people go out and check out your book if they're interested, whether they're skeptical or not. So I'll just read out again. It's David Fitzgerald, and your first book in 2010 was Nailed: 10 Christian Myths That Show Jesus Never Existed at All. And then you've written a book subsequent called Jesus Mything in Action. Is that a verb?
Mything in, yes, that is being used as a verb. It's myth, not missing.
I myth, you myth, he myths, they myth. I like that. That's good. So not only have you written an interesting book, but you've invented a new verb.
This is the thing. And I should point out that Mything in Action is actually a 3-volume set, because the book wound up being so huge that it was better to make it 3 reader-friendly size books. And actually, you know, while I'm talking to your audience, on a completely unrelated note, my wife and I have also written a science fiction trilogy through a UK publisher, Titan Books in the UK. So if you're interested in time travel, post-apocalyptic science fiction-y adventure stuff, there's a book called Time Shards. And book 2 is coming out in January, and we'll be finishing up book 3 very soon too.
I do love science fiction. I listen to a podcast called Clark's World. And that's
Arthur C. Clarke's World? Oh, that's awesome.
It's awesome, isn't it? Yeah. But I'm not here to talk about Clarke's World. I'm here to talk about you. So at the end of every podcast, we have a song for people. And I thought a really great song for your podcast would be Personal Jesus by Depeche Mode.
I love it.
So I'm not going to sing it to you now, David. I'll be honest. I put it on at the end after we've stopped talking. That's what happens, really. But nobody knows, so don't.
That is a great song choice. Don't
spoil that for anyone. It gets tacked on at the end after we've stopped talking.
All right. Hey, do you know the singer, the Australian singer, Shelley Siegel?
No, I don't know. Is she related to Jonathan Livingston?
What's that? No relation. You have to have her on the show sometime, because you will absolutely love her, and she's a doll. But she's actually written a song called Jesus Mything in Action.
Oh, really? What, like she's songed your book?
We did an event together, and one night we were just kind of riffing, and I gave her the words to a song, and she did the music to her, and her husband did the music to the words.
If I'd known that, I would have put her song on the end, but I didn't know it.
Yeah, we'll have to get that. We'll have to fix that for next time.
That's great. Thank you so much. So listen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm really grateful, because I know you do public speaking, and I can only pay you in double entendres. And
yes, bring me more peanuts. More peanuts.
But if you want a double entendre, I can give you one.
Oh, do. Always.
No, that's it.
Oh.
That was it. That was the double entendre. If you want a double entendre, I can give you one. And then I do a big wink, a big leery wink, but you can't see that because it's a podcast.
Okay. Very nice.
So thank you so much for coming on. It's been really interesting, and I hope people check out your books.
Thanks so much. And I hope you do. And let me know what you think of the book as well.
Definitely. Yeah. Great. And I'd like to thank all my 3 listeners for listening to another JW Community podcast.
I double that. Which county that's fair? You're wrong, personal Jesus.
on your chest. You need to confess. I will deliver. You know I'm a forgiver. Reach out and touch me. Reach out and touch me. I will deliver.